Acast recommends.
Hello, I'm William Hanson, the luxury co-host of Help I Sexted My Boss.
And I'm Jordan North. This summer, I'm taking control and giving William the holiday of a lifetime in Benidorm.
I wish I could say I was excited.
The best thing about this trip is that you can come with us. With thanks to Amazon Music, we're going to be taking 10 pairs of lucky listeners to Spain. Flights, accommodation, and a night out with us. What could be better than that?
Well, I can think of a few things.
If you want to be a part of Diva España with Amazon Music and want to be with us in Benidorm, follow and listen to Sexted now to find out how to win.
Olé!
Acast is the home of podcasting,
including such shows as
The Girls' Bathroom,
The Magnus Archives,
and the one you're listening to right now. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Merry Christmas and welcome to Old Brother, a podcast about Salford/Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. Now, as you'll hear in a minute, it's probably just Manchester. You can find us at Spotify, Apple and all usual suspects, where we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. All our episodes are also available on YouTube. You can search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Our Christmas special this year is a Q&A with the inestimable Danny Knope, the Indiana Jones of obscure Fall-rated facts, who despite his best efforts singularly fails to unearth any new information. Still, God loves a tryer. Hope you enjoy it. Right, here we are. Christmas 2022 made it. The Christmas edition of Old Brother with me, Paul Hanley, and my esteemed brother, Stephen. Good evening, Steve. You all right?
Hello, good evening. Yeah, I'm all right.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, all the best.
Yeah, so for those avid followers at home who've listened to Wrapped with rapt attention to every episode, this is the Christmas episode, and as if you've heard any of those, these have even less structure or make less sense than any of the other episodes, which is takes some doing.
Well, we have only done one though before.
Oh, we've done two.
What was the first one?
It was just me and you, I think.
Oh, okay.
I got to see you've done your research anyway, Steve. That's good. Right, so we're joined today. We decided we were going to have some kind of a quiz with somebody testing our knowledge of The Fall, and there is only one candidate for that, really. Known to millions as Danny Knoll on The Fall website and the annotated Fall and everywhere else. If you say you had size 11 feet, Dan will correct you and say, actually, I think you'll find at that time you had size 10 and a half. No. He's forgotten more about The Fall than I'll ever know. So, good afternoon, Dan. How are you?
Afternoon. I'm fine, thanks. Yeah, known to dozens. Yeah.
I'll say that.
Right, so we decided that we have been given some stick for not, including by the person who's joining us today, for not doing our research when we talk about certain topics. So we decided what we would do is we would ask Dan to test our knowledge of The Fall and see how we get. Now, there's going to be some fairly big gaps in knowledge here. If not, I hope there's no gaps in the conversation, but there will definitely be gaps in knowledge. But I'm sure Dan can put us right. Right, okay, without further ado, Dan, off you go.
Worst. Yeah, this isn't in the easiest thing to do because I had to compromise between throwing lots of questions at you where the answer is going to be can't remember and don't know. It'd just be an hour of conversational dead ends. So I've got some kind of general questions. Questions that I'm interested in, and some more precise questions where maybe you'll know and maybe you won't. So we'll see.
Whatever happens. We're all here to chat. We don't care.
Yeah. We'll see how we go.
Okay.
Just to start with a bit of geography, first of all, because you always start these podcasts, Paul, by describing The Fall as a Salford/Manchester band.
Yes.
And I wondered why you describe it that way. Why Salford/Manchester?
That's a good question, that, because Mark always tried to maintain he was from Salford, but...
Yeah, he wasn't.
He was born in Manchester, wasn't he?
Well, he was born in Manchester, lived in Prestwich, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but didn't he move? Didn't where he was born move from Salford to Manchester at some point?
Possibly in the distant past, yeah. But his parents were from Salford, weren't they? So I think
his parents were from Salford, yeah. So I mean, he got himself up for Salford, so that's why.
I mean, that sort of grew during that Manchester thing, didn't he, where he wanted to stay away from all that and didn't want to be associated with Manchester bands.
Yeah.
So he started staying, he was from Salford more.
I was going to ask you about that because he did often, not always, say that he didn't consider the fall of Manchester band, but and it was just interesting whether that mattered to you as well, because you were kind of, I know, Steve, you were born in Dublin, weren't you? And
I lived in Manchester all my life.
Sorry, I missed that.
I've lived in Manchester all my life, practically.
Yeah.
I also thought it was a Manchester band, or thought of the Fall as a Manchester band, definitely.
It's interesting to me because it's kind of like describing yourself as a Manchester band is, it puts you in a particular place, doesn't it? And at certain times, it's meant certain things.
Yeah.
I remember when I was at university, sort of starting in 89, there were a couple of people on my course who left to go to Manchester. I was in Birmingham and they left to go to Manchester specifically to connect up with everything that was happening around then. It's quite interesting.
Well, I mean, you know, it has got something of a tradition of music, Manchester. So, I mean, what I always say is you've got what Mark said in interviews and what he actually thought. They're not always the same thing. So you get an interview with Mark and he'll say, the people in Liverpool always got the Fall better than people in Manchester, which is categorically not true, is it? I mean, people in Liverpool like the Fall, but some of the time things he said in conversations are just to be interesting, I think, which, you know, and thank God he was, because, you know, interviews can be dull affairs, but they were never were with Mark, were they?
I always considered, generally we all lived in South Manchester, didn't we? Me, you, Mark, Riley, and you travelled to Prestwich, but I always thought you just basically go to North Manchester.
Yeah.
You're going through Cheetah Mill. Yeah, you're going through Cheetah Mill and then you're there, aren't you?
Yeah.
I don't know why, but as I say, it's just one of them things where if everybody wants to be from Manchester, Mark wants to be from Salford.
He doesn't, yeah.
And if everybody wants to be from Greater Manchester, Mark will move to Edinburgh.
That's exactly it, yeah. Yeah.
It's just the contrariness of it, isn't it? That's what
you're
it
right.
is. You were talking about Liverpool there, and the Fall, I think in your time as well, played Eric's quite a lot before it closed, whenever that was. And I know that people like Julian Cope and Ian McCulloch and that kind of came out of that period. Did you feel a lot of kinship with the kind of Liverpool bands at the time? Particularly,
I think Eric's was just. I think the last Eric's gigs were just before I joined. I think they did it. Change its name to Brady's or something, Steve?
It did, yeah.
Yeah, it did, yeah. It did.
So I played there. I mean, it was ostensibly the same club, but yeah, I think we did actually because Ian and Julian Colt were sort of inverted commas roadies, weren't they? Before you, Steve, or was it the same time as you?
Yeah, it was just before me, and a couple of gigs just when I joined.
Yeah,
they were around, but yeah, and I never saw them lifting.
Sort of lift a screwdriver. But I mean, Will and we used to hang around, didn't we?
See, we would like travel to see the Fall and hang about and talk to Mark. Yeah,
walk past us to talk to Mark.
Yeah. and then sort of graduated to supporting us.
Yeah.
Well, I saw a great. I saw Echo and the Bunnymen support the Fall at the Factory before they had Peter Freitas. They were still the drum machine. And there was some hoo-ha about Ian McCulloch locked the dressing room door because he was doing his hair and nobody could get in. If I recall, is that true? Did you remember that?
I don't remember that now. Well, I can imagine it's true. I would imagine it may be true, but
well, no, they were amazing. They were, without even, Peter Faiers was an absolutely brilliant drummer. I mean, genius kind of drummer. But even with just the little drum machine, they were a fantastic band.
Yeah.
And of course, Reddit in Books is a complete lift of stepping out, isn't it?
Well, Julian Cope, there's some live clips of him on YouTube playing that. Stepping out and then going into Reddit in Books and kind of doing a bit of a chat about it at the same time. Yeah, yeah. So he owns up to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's very little room for taking the moral high ground there. I mean, all music's ripped off, isn't it? Let's face it.
Yeah.
There's nothing new out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Do you, as Stephen Paul, do you have quite similar musical tastes, or are they quite different in some? Paul, I know you're a big Beatles fan, and
yeah, I think that's probably similar. If you're talking about the Holy Grail stuff, so the Stooges and Bowie and all that, that's all the same, you know. But I mean, you have to fill the form in when you join the fall to say you like that. But yeah, pretty much. But I think I'm a bit more '60s Beatles than Steve is. I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But yeah, paths do cross a lot, don't they?
They do cross a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think I've listened to very little new music now. It's shameful, really. I mean, but I find it very difficult to listen to new bands because I'm an old fart, basically. This sounds just like X, Y, and Z every time, which is a terrible way to be, and it's not something I'm particularly proud of.
Yeah. Well, I there's never been a time when you wouldn't think that about music, is there?
The Beatles are ripping off bloody Leadbelly and the rubbish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's just you get to a point where it's harder to excite you, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Well, what used to excite you does not. I mean, somewhere you could write a song, couldn't you? So who's winning this quiz so far, Dan?
Yeah, it's not much of, I wanted to ask as well about the Can Club.
Oh, yeah.
Because you mention it a few times, Steve, in your book, and but there's not much said about it anywhere else. And from about 1980, September 1980, I'm just interested who played and how long did it go on for, and what was the thinking behind it, and who was involved. And
well, it was this club that we all used to go to called the Cypress Tavern, and a lot of bands used to go to, and it was open late, and you did see Mick Hucknall in there and other bands. And they had this really nice room downstairs, and me, Mark and Craig decided to put bands on there. So we had, let's see, who did we have? We had, trouble with it was we ran out of bands that we could all agree on fairly quickly. That we all liked and wanted to put on. We had
Orange Juice, obviously.
We had Orange Juice on, early on, and James we had on.
James was the first gig with Tim singing.
Yeah.
We had a girl singer, and James was like the sort of backing vocals / bass figure.
Yeah. Is that when they were known as, what is it, Model Team International?
Model Team International at the time, yeah.
Yeah, they had to change the name. They were called Model Team International because I think one of their girlfriends worked at this Model Team International, which was obviously a modelling agency, and these had free T-shirts. So they called themselves that, and they had free T-shirts of the band, but I think they got hit with a cease and desist fairly quickly from actual Model Team International.
Yeah. It was just that, really. It was just sort of a group of mates putting bands on.
Yeah.
Who else was on? Hamsters were on. Frantic Elevators.
Yeah, we had the Things on a lot.
Not the Frantic Elevators, and the Things were on.
Yeah, with John Marr.
The Freshies were on.
Yeah. I think that was the one that broke it, I think, because I don't think Craig liked him at all.
He took his ball on at that point.
Yeah.
I put a ball on. Oh, I say we. It was nothing to do with me. They had me working the door a couple of times. But
wow.
Put the fall on.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's that one, right? Okay.
Yeah, we did two nights. One upstairs. I was in the band by then, so it was one upstairs and one downstairs. We did two nights on the bounce.
Okay. Yeah.
It was good. It was just a, like that. Just mates hanging out and trying to put bands on that we liked.
Yeah. But it didn't carry on for that long then.
Well, then there was that. There was the disagreement on who to put on, and we didn't really agree. And then we started touring, and it all. So started touring pretty heavily just after that, and it all had to take a back seat.
Any other good bands on? And we've only named three so far. There must have been more than that.
Also, we put Alana Pele on, didn't we?
Yeah. Did the Passage play? No, or did I dream that?
Passage did play. Yeah.
They were a laugh, weren't they? The Passage.
I've got the Not Sensibles written down here as someone who played.
I
don't think Craig was the biggest Not Sensibles fan in the world, do you?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. What was that? Did they have a particular hit, the Not Sensibles?
I don't know.
They weren't Iggy Pop's jacket, were they? Who was that? If only there was some way of finding out.
I think there might have been, yeah.
Iggy Pop's jacket.
I'm not familiar with them at all.
Oh, no, that was those Naughty Lumps. That's a different band altogether. Oh. Never had them on. Okay. Not Sensible. So if you put a gun to my head and said, name a Not Sensible song, we would be picking my brains off the carpet. Yeah. I'm in love with Margaret Thatcher.
Oh,
apparently.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Put them on. Who's idea was that?
I don't think they meant it.
No, I know that. I didn't mean that. I just meant, how did they come on the radar to get a gig at the Can Club?
I have no idea. No idea how that worked.
Right, okay. He's probably making it up. Probably spot the deliberate lie.
I mean, look, I could build this up that it was a forerunner of the Hacienda here, couldn't I?
Yeah. Well, that's it.
They nicked all our ideas.
Yeah. And the name of that young man? Alan Erasmus.
Yeah.
I said to this bloke in the toilet, someone should do this at a better venue.
Moving on, shall we move on from that?
Moving on, yeah.
Come on, Bamba Gascoigne.
Netherlands tour, June 1980, which is the one you had to sit out, Paul, I think.
One of the ones I had to sit out.
One of the ones. You didn't have much luck with the Netherlands, did you? Or the United States. So. I think a previous of one of your podcasts, it was described as a disastrous tour, because it all seemed to be booked at the last minute. And I was trying to look at how many gigs were played, and Steve Davies said that there were 11 gigs in 14 days, but the world only knows about four of them that are documented. And I just wondered if you remember anything else at all about them. And then there was an ICA gig in London after it.
I remember the ICA gig.
Uh-huh.
Peter Purvis was there.
Yeah. That's the point that's caused a lot of discussion.
I knew that one. But anyway, back to Steve Davis. I was delighted when they got Steve Davis in. I mean, God bless him. He wasn't bad on the congas, but he was a terrible drummer.
Yeah, yeah.
So then I thought, oh, that's happy days, that. And then when they said, we're getting somebody else in to do the American tour, all right, who's that? Carl Burns, the greatest fucking drummer in the world. That wasn't quite the same. Wasn't quite the same sense of relief for Lil.
No.
I don't think we did 11 gigs in 14 days. I don't.
Yeah.
We maybe did 7 or 8.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
So there's nothing on there about any.
We only know four of them. I've found a couple. There's only four.
You right.
Go on. So what were they? Amsterdam, presumably.
Rotterdam, Eindhoven. I'm not sure the pronunciation. Yeah. Nijmegen. Not sure how you pronounce it. And Vorburg.
Nijmegen. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
It can't have been four, though, can it? It wouldn't have gone just to do four, sure.
I think it's about 6 or 7 in a couple of weeks. They did do seem to remember sitting around a lot in some squat in Amsterdam a lot.
That could be any number of years, couldn't it? Let's face it.
Yeah.
And then the following year, I think, Paul, you did make it to the Netherlands.
I did. We seem to be in Holland every 5 minutes. If I think back to the fall, I think we seem to be there every other bloody month. I mean, I'm sure we weren't.
Well, they did have that really good setup, didn't they, with all them sort of venues that all seem to be like subsidised. And
it's not that big a place either, is it? So you could get to everywhere fairly.
Yeah.
There seemed to be a lot of youth clubs and things like that.
It was a great idea that, you know, they'd have these little clubs on the outside of town that were subsidised by the government. And so obviously they could attract bands and pay fees and you know, everyone to go there and be out, you know, see a gig, a cheap gig.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Yeah. Do you remember what the problem was about going from the Netherlands to Belgium and then into Germany? And then back again. That year.
It was a Carnet thing, was it?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. Do you know, Steve?
I have no idea. I'm trying to...
So you go for Belgium. So Holland to Belgium.
Yeah.
And then Belgium to Germany.
Holland to Belgium, back to the Netherlands for Groningen, wherever you pronounce that, then into Germany. But there was a problem about getting back into the Netherlands, apparently, because it wasn't realised that Groningen wasn't in Germany. So there were visa problems, apparently.
Right. Well, so what year was this then? Was it this 81?
81.
So I might have been gone by then anyway, because I missed the end of that tour.
Yeah.
Because was that the tour we did, me and Carl did Alternate Nights, presumably?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I bugged off just before they went to Berlin.
Ah, right.
So that passed me back. Yeah, I did one of you. It must have been a wrench, Steve.
How did you get on?
Me and I got the boat. Me and who was driving for us? Was it the guy out of Smack? The singer out of Smack was driving for us. Do you remember him?
Right. Well, yeah.
His missus was on the tour, and me and her got the boat back. Because I was 81. I can't have had. Maybe I had my end of year exams at college or something. But I definitely came back early. Oh, that was right. I couldn't play in Berlin. They wouldn't let me play because I was only 17 or whatever. I couldn't get a visa to go into Berlin to play. So I came home, and then they did Berlin. Front page interviewing the Melody Maker with about 15 pictures of Carl and no mention of me. Bastards. I can tell you, Christ. I haven't been gone 5 minutes. Not that it's a sore point.
Apparently the final gig has to be put.
Until you've let it go.
Yeah. I'm going to forgive you.
Apparently the final gig had to be played with borrowed equipment. But...
Well, we borrowed a lot of equipment to go to tour.
Yeah.
Europe anyway, not a lot of the time. You didn't take a drum kit with you.
Yeah.
Although, I believe Mike Lee always insisted on taking his drum kit. He even took his drum kit to America.
Wow.
Because his was slightly different because he had like proper animal skins and it was like a sort of old 60s kit, so he wouldn't play just any kit. But I never got afforded the same. To be honest, my kit, I was glad of anybody's kit. Anybody's was always going to be better than mine. So yeah. I was quite happy to use borrowed gear.
I mean, I have no idea, you know, what it's like touring with drums, but it's kind of putting them in a van and driving around the Netherlands.
Yeah, so if I ever come back, if I'm ever in Canada, I'm coming back as a penny whistle player.
try it with two kits.
Fucking hell. it was a joy, wasn't it, Steve? It's the, you know, the best years of your life.
Who'd do that again?
Who'd do that again? You think we'd learn? Jesus Christ. I'm hoping. I've never played a gig with Simon where we both have. Well, I have done one, but I'm hoping he takes more of an interest in taking his kit down than Carl used to. Let's put it that way. I'm not doing it. I'm all for that now.
I'm looking forward to all that. It's but oh,
that's cool, yeah.
My next question is about Jumper Clown.
Oh,
so which obviously was Mark Riley's, I don't know if it was his first single, but one of his first singles.
It was not his first single. His first single was Favourite Sister, featuring Mr. Craig Scanlon, Mr. Stephen Huntley, Mr. Paul Huntley.
So the credits on that, is that the one where the, or am I getting mixed up with something else? The credits on something of Swing and Cog Sinister. What's that? I've got a note down here, something about that.
Swing?
I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe that's an Andrew Berry thing. I've got a question about Andrew Berry later on.
All right, okay.
I'll get to that. Yeah. So you played on some of that. But is it true that the basic tune for Jumper Clown was originally performed by The Fall when Riley
was? The keyboard riff on Jumper Clown is what Mark used to play on the Manager Expanded. Is there no tape of that out there? There must be. There must be a version of the Manager Expanded with the Jumper Clown riff on.
Yeah. Yeah. It was played as an intro for a bit, I think. But
yes, it was.
I'm getting mixed up. Yeah. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think so. You can see it fits, can't you?
Yeah. It's a shame it didn't make it onto the single.
Really? A recording search for a keyboard riff, isn't it, that?
Yeah.
Am I there? Am I wrong?
No, I think you might be right. But,
no, I think I'm right. I think I'm right. Because I think that... I think they even did that. There's a... With Martin, when Martin was still in the band, they did that, I think.
Oh.
Riff.
Oh, right.
It was an intro for a while. Wasn't it called Fuck Knows or something?
Yes, it was.
Oh. It was.
Oh, that's new.
Mark Smith said to Mark Riley, what do you want to call it? And he said Fuck Knows, and then that's what got the call.
Yeah. That's a working title.
I think that's the same riff as Manager Expanded. I might be wrong, but it was definitely... A Fall riff, let's put it that way. But it does fit, I think. I'm glad we're getting all this cleared up, Dan.
Well, it's a long list of questions I need to know.
My memory of that is that, obviously when Mark Riley, and Mark Smith's like sitting us all down and going like, don't worry about Mark. We'll look after him. You know, we'll make sure he's all right.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Mark will be fine. Don't worry. He'll be fine. And then when he found out we'd played on Mark's first recordings, he's like, I'm not fucking buying you strings so you can play with someone else.
Fucking
Yeah.
It didn't last long, did it? We're looking after him.
No. That goodwill didn't last long, no.
No,
there was that Hey Mark Riley song, wasn't there, later on?
Turns all the time I think of that, to be honest.
I'll move on to happier times then.
Yeah, move on, yeah.
English Scheme, the starting point for which was that tape of Birdsong and an Ice Cream Van, and Mark Riley inverted the sound of the Ice Cream Van. But what was the tune of the Ice Cream Van?
What
would it be?
There's a standard set, isn't there, of Ice Cream Van tunes.
It's not Green Sleeves, is it?
I wondered if it was, yeah.
Slaves. Could be. It wasn't the most accurate transcription of all time, I don't think.
Well, it didn't have to be. Yeah. You think it might have been Greensleeve? Because, yeah, there's like a handful of common Ice Cream Van tunes we'll play.
But. Yeah. Well, what comes around here now, which including in the last week, the Ice Cream Man is playing the Thunderbirds theme, which I think is a bit weird for an Ice Cream Man, but...
to learn.
Yeah, Ice Cream round in December, playing Thunderbirds theme.
Wow.
He's selling something else.
We've got whole tours here where we can't remember. We can't remember who was in the band, but we're supposed to remember the bleeding riff the Ice Cream Man was playing.
You can kind of vaguely hear it, I think, but it's too difficult for me to hear. I don't like have those kind of ears, you know. But.
Right, okay, well, I'll do what Steve did. I'll say some vague conjecture and portray it as fact, you know, like in his book. So it was 100% Green Sleeves.
Thank you.
I'm only joking. It's funny because it's true.
In the North Will Rise Again, right? Where he's got his little fantasy of English Scheme being played on Junior Choice, right? And he says the lyric talks about it being played on the grand piano and was turned into a love song. So I wondered if on Junior Choice there'd been Greensleeves played on a piano or something, and he was basing it on kind of something real that happened. Because quite a lot in that song.
You're spending too much time thinking about the fall, Dan.
Yeah, well,
you need to take a break. Go walk around the block, smell some flowers.
It's too late for that now.
I always did think it would be a good idea to attempt to rewrite English Scheme as a love song on a grand piano. It would be good to do that, wouldn't it? Yeah. How they did it, I don't know, but it would be good.
I had this big theory about it being Greensleeves or something. That, then it would make sense.
You never played Greensleeves on Junior Choice. It was all three wheels on my wagon. And then I'm trying to play Greensleeves. You know, because there's nothing the 7 or 8 year olds of this country like more after they've just heard My Brother by Terry Scott. Oh, they've now heard Greensleeves played by the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra.
They used to play some weird stuff on those programmes, didn't they?
Sparky's Magic Piano.
Was it Bernard Cribbins and all?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Welcome. Stupot, wasn't it? Stupot used to introduce it. Yeah. Or Tom Blackburn did for a bit with that dog.
Yeah. I don't
know. Bernard Cribbins was up. They used to play Right Said Fred, didn't they?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah,
he definitely did. Right, moving on from that then. WMC Blob 59. What is Blob 59?
Well, a blob is the hot wine used to sell in Yates's.
Right.
Yes, I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, 59 is. How much it was? 59 pence? I don't know. Well, it's a bit dear back then, money, 59 pence. I mean, that's I don't know. Since you became Blob 59, I've spent a lot of time wondering who and what the hell was the crime. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I don't know why the Yates's blob fits in there, but that's the only blob I'm aware of.
Yeah. Then Mark and Kay did used to go there though, didn't they, and have that?
Yeah.
Which kind of the one in Manchester near?
I might be reaching here. Were they not numbered? Were they not the drinks they sold in Yates is not numbered? So maybe the blob was number 59, possibly.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, they used to have numbers by them, so you can order your drinks by. I'll have a 59 or I'll have a 60, whatever. Because obviously, Blob was a colloquial name for it, wasn't it? I'm sure that's not the official name.
Yeah, right.
No.
I mean, if it is, the marketing board needs to have a word, don't they? What are we going to call this drink? A blob.
There's a research project in that one, I think.
Yeah.
Hours.
There we are.
So, yes, Blob 59 is about the drink from, it's the number of the ordering one in Yates's Wine Lodge.
That's now a fact.
Until you prove wrong,
I shall be off to the library and look that one up.
don't doubt it for a moment.
Slate, is it an album?
Yes. Move on, next question.
There is a question.
You could get into this because it was in the singles chart, wasn't it?
It was.
In the singles chart.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where it was designed not to get into some of the charts and as a deliberate kind of messing about kind of thing, wasn't it? Yeah. But that doesn't mean you can't consider it whatever you want to consider it, really.
Yeah. No, I think it was more the thing of we went in there. We only went in for a couple of days, didn't we? We went in to do a single.
Yeah.
And came out with a lot more than we went, you know, that we thought we would.
Mm.
And it just sort of captured that. Yeah, obviously, yeah. Not enough to do an album.
No.
So it just kind of captured them few days.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no sort of taking it anywhere else or re-recording or anything. It's just what we recorded in them days.
So here's the question for you then, Stephen. If the idea was to go in and do a single,
yeah,
which two songs off Slates were supposed to be the single?
Well, it won't fit and working again because that was made up in the studio, wasn't it?
That was made up in the studio, yeah.
I think, did we have All the Love of
Slates was never going to be a single, was it? You couldn't have that as a single, the song.
We had that before we went in, though. We did. That was written, yeah. Leave the Capital.
I mean, that could have been a single, couldn't it? I suppose that's one of the popular things.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose it was that, maybe.
Well, the reason I always say it's an album is it's quite short for an album, but it's definitely miles too long for a single, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think a lot of people that insist on it being an album do so because it's a significant piece of work and they want it to have that status, you know?
Definitely. Well, the reason I always say it's an album is because that means I played on more Fall albums than... If it was a single, that's the bottom line. At the end of the day, I can say I played on five albums instead of four or whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, it's
quite a run of albums as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, it's one of the greatest Fall records and one of my favourite records ever. So
it's a great. I really like the production on that without being too wanky about it, but I think that's really. The balance between sort of noise and music is perfect, I think.
Yeah, I agree. It is. Yeah. Just on Kay Carroll, because you mentioned her then, and you've told some stories about her, and you know she could be pretty fierce, but quite protective of the group and you and so on different occasions. And how much do you think the Fall's survival over those, you know, the first 5-6 years owed to her and how effective she was as a manager?
I think what the thing that came, the Fall could have turned into a normal group in a lot of ways. I think when you had Mark, Martin, Tony, Carl and Una, that could have been like a group of five individuals who were more or less equals, and they could have become a fairly mainstream group. They're certainly good enough to become a fairly mainstream group. I think, but whether it was all Kay, whether it was all Mark, once Kay got on board, it evolved into this kind of band that was completely different to any other band. I think that's a lot of that had to do with her, I think. She's got the influence on Mark.
What, in terms of sound or the way things should be done?
The big thing in sound was when they started getting people like me and Steve who were not rubbish, but we weren't, you know, we weren't, certainly you wouldn't call us slick. We were kind of self-taught, self-sort of, and we'd learned, I'd grown up listening to the Fall. Not necessarily sound, but just the sort of ethos of the band, I think.
Yeah.
Was that okay? Or some of it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of kind of principles for it went out the window, didn't they, later on? But whether that was right or wrong, or, you know,
I don't think it mattered so much because it was kind of set in people's minds what kind of band the Fall were. So even when the Fall stopped playing that kind of game and played a different, there was still always that there, wasn't it, with the Fall?
Mm, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. You're setting yourself up for these principles. That, for what, though? For what? I don't
know. I don't know. But that whole, there was that whole, I mean, it wasn't just a fall. No. A whole sort of straitjacket of not selling out was, I mean, it did get quite restrictive, I think. You know, that, oh, you can't do that, selling out. And I think, I think there was a big kickback against that with New Romantics. I think they sort of said, well, bollocks to this. We're going to sell out. We don't, you know, we're going to wear selling out as a badge of honour. We've had enough of black and white and raincoats and everything else. We want to go and kind of celebrate life a bit, you know.
Yeah. Just, I'm interested in the kind of, I don't know how best to describe it, the kind of untutored musicality of when you were all...
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it, though.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to be insulting, you know. I mean, you weren't kind of musicians.
It was certainly true in my case, untutored musicality. I hadn't done.
What surprised me is that I've come to learn, like, you know, over the years and reading about other bands, and there's a lot of bands like that, isn't there?
Right. Yeah.
We've heard, not anymore, but back then you kind of think, well, God, we were the only ones. But then you read books about other bands, and the way they approach it is just as chaotic and just as kind of making it up as they go along. And
it makes some really interesting music, doesn't it?
I think that Will Sargent book that I read recently, they were like that, the Bunnymen, really. They were, Les Patterson was sort of, you know, learning to play the bass as he was doing the gigs. And
Do you think it kind of means that there is only you that can sound like that, because you're not kind of reaching for the standard ways of playing?
I think there's definitely a bit of that, I think. Not so much with the drumming, because, you know, the thing about it, if it's going to be a rock or, rock and roll, there's a certain style of drumming that you have to do. But I think certainly Craig's guitar was informed a lot by the fact that he could only play like Craig.
He
was never going to be a pale imitation of anybody else, because he could only play like himself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, yeah. I think those albums, kind of, particularly for me anyway, Grotesque through, the next 3-4 albums that you were on, Paul, and they do have a kind of a sound that's unique to them. No one else sounded like it like that at all. And then of course you get Brixim, who's playing a more traditional lead guitar sound, and it changes again, doesn't it? I was interested in how much that changed for you, whether the way you wrote music changed much over time as you learned more, or did it not really?
A little bit, not a great deal. Obviously, the more you do, you start off writing a song, and you come, like we said about the Man Who's Head Expanded, you just write a riff and present it to the band. But you start thinking about other songs and bringing middle eights into it if you want, and trying to make it more of a complete song.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, which is what we've kind of not done with House of All. Is they're not songs, really. They're more that kind of soundscape that we did before. That, which is really interesting, because I've never done that. Any band that was in after the fall, there was always songs, really. Like, we were in Tom's band, they were all songs, and the Extricate were all songs, really.
Yeah.
None of that sort of, here's a riff, let's play it for 15 minutes to see where it goes. I mean, I think ideally you want to be able to do both, don't you, most of the time? But it's been great to do, actually, because, as I say, we've not done it for years, that kind of build it up and see where it takes us. And, but it was really interesting to do that House of All album that way, because we went in the studio, I mean, literally with nothing. Nobody sent anybody any riffs or sent anybody any songs, or we didn't rehearse or anything.
Obviously, Martin had a few ideas, didn't he, of the way he wanted it to go?
Yeah. They were only ideas, weren't they? They weren't.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, they were.
Steve, you mentioned the Man Whose Head Expanded there. Was that a comic book character?
No, I don't think it was.
Ah, okay. There's a hint of it in your book, I think, but when you weren't.
You're not getting mixed up with plastic, man.
No, he's definitely Manny's had expanded.
No, it might have been a Twilight Zone or something, was it?
I don't know.
Mark May have got it from the Twilight Zone, or
it's somewhere in your book, I think, about a comic book or something. But
all right, you'll have to read it, Stu. It's very good. You should read it.
I am ready. I don't think it's that. Yeah, maybe we researched it out at the time and it was, but
yeah.
It's all gone now. All gone like tears in the rain. Yeah. Can't remember anymore.
Yeah. A lot's happened in 8 years, you know.
Yeah, well.
Oh,
exactly. Yeah. That's true. One of the things that I've found doing trivia research, and one of the things that your podcast proves is how frail memories are, isn't it?
It's
scary. Yeah.
I think that these last couple of years have sort of done things to people's memories anyway.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think just that sitting around for 2 years and nothing to sort of link memories to and as affected people.
Yeah.
You can see how people go absolutely bonkers in prison, can't you? You know, if it's the same thing every day. I mean, it's only a shadow of that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Every day is the same as the last one.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. Yeah, well, moving on. Happier times again. NatWest, Paul, your picture was used in Viz in 1984 based on that photograph of everyone trying to look as posh as possible. And years later, Mark told the Melody Maker that he'd said that you should sue them and that you got 100 T-shirts and a lifetime subscription to Viz.
Yeah.
He did, by the way, describe you as the brother of a bloke who used to be in the band.
Charming, right?
Is any of that remotely true, other than the brother of a bloke who used to be in the band?
I never sued them. I never held any thought of suing them, funnily enough. But I did get a free subscription. It didn't last a lifetime. I've not got any more, let's put it that way. I got two T-shirts, which is slightly less than 100.
Right. There we go.
Man. Oh man,
I was delighted. Why would I sue them? I was made up. Still up.
Yeah. Really?
But that always got me about Mark, though. It's like the drummer said this, and the brother. It's like, you don't remember the guy's name.
He must have had a reason to kind of have a go at you at the time, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because there were other times. He did say that you and Paul were going to be the greatest rhythm section. You know, so
it
wasn't always.
Funnily enough, there was a time where we were going to be. And there was never the time where we were, though, was there? You said that these two were the greatest rhythm section of all time. That was never happening.
Gros Chapelle. Why is it pronounced Gros Chapelle in the British Grenadiers pairing? It's Chapel, isn't it? But everyone pronounces it Chapelle.
Gros Chapelle.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't know that. That's Chapel.
Yeah. No, it seems to be, unless I'm just getting the accents, but whenever I've heard Brix mention it, it's Chapelle, and in the song, I think it's Chapelle as well. I should have
looked at it again. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. And I just, why?
Why?
Why not? There you go.
Yeah.
Disparate Cogcenti. Compilation. I was going to ask you what you all felt about that, and was it thought to be a really good idea? That a lot of people on it are people you would know, I guess. You've got Andrew Berry's on there, and John the Postman on there, and you've got Saffron Pryor's granddad on there, and all that.
And Phil
Johnson.
Phil Schoenfeld.
Phil Schoenfeld as well, It's kind of they're all people who seem, or mainly people that seem to be known to the group and that.
Did you have any input on that scene?
I was one of the directors of Oxinister, believe it or not.
Yeah. I can tell you who isn't on it. Who sent in a tape and was roundly turned down, band called Shout Bamalam. We sent them a tape and we said not. And we were told in no uncertain terms it we weren't acceptable.
Wow.
You know, he didn't want to make it nepotistic.
Oh, no, no, not at all. No, no. His girlfriend's granddad, that's fine, but.
You know, they can answer that so far. No, I don't know. It's one of another one of Mark's short-lived ideas to have a label.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, yeah, that's what he had around at the time. Mm. And then again, God, I wonder if there's any of them albums out there.
We had
hundreds of them, didn't we?
Yeah,
years in the.
Moving on, Drago's Guilt. Does it have anything to do with the band Victor Drago?
Yes.
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Steve Davis.
Yeah, again.
See, Davis was the drummer in Victor Drago.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the lyric's about. I don't think the actual lyric is to do with them. I don't think so. I mean, I might be wrong, but I mean, Victor Drago, was he in 2000 AD or one of them, I think?
Tornado,
right. Maybe it's pre-2000 AD, possibly. But yeah, I mean, the protagonist of the song, I don't know whether that's one of the band. I don't think so.
Mm. So just borrow the name.
Yeah. Definitely got it from them.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. But no lyrical connection, maybe then.
Well, I don't know, is the short answer. About any lyric, is we were no more privy to what the songs were about than anybody. I mean, occasionally, you got a little glimmers, but not. It was certainly, what's this song about, Mark? It was, that never happened, ever.
Yeah.
God, no, you couldn't ask that.
No.
Your business.
No, it's none of our business. No, do I tell you how to play baseball? You do, yeah. Yeah, but,
Lucifer over Lancashire. Whose voice is it at the beginning if it's not Craig Scanlon?
Oh, God, man.
Do you know?
It's not Craig. It's not Craig, is it?
Wow. Because it's used again, isn't it, on Symbol of Mordgan, which is him, but there's another snippet at the end of that. So I think everybody's assumed it's Craig because it's included at the end of that. But you I think have said that it wasn't him. But so
yeah.
But maybe it's just somebody at random on the radio then. But
you were there, Steve. You must remember.
It's the monster. No, I don't. But I don't think I could. No, it did come up, didn't it, on something? It was flowing around there recently, and I had a listen, and I don't think it's Craig.
Yeah, it was on Twitter. I think you said it wasn't.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, it remains a mystery then.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and. Bombast, which you said I think is based on a Dolly Parton tune.
What?
Yes.
Is it out of order for me to guess which one?
Well, it depends if you can remember.
I can't tell. I don't. I had an album. Oh, my wife at the time had an album.
Yeah.
That she kept playing, and it had that one. It's all really good bass line.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom. What do you think it is, Dan?
Well, it sounds a bit like a song called I Can't Be True, but.
Okay.
Let me write that down. I Can't Be True.
Maybe.
I'll have a listen and give you my considered opinion.
Yeah.
Well, you should know, Steve. You listened to it.
But it was 30 years ago.
I know, but if you listen to I Can't Be True.
Oh, if I listen to it, yeah.
The same process as it did when you ripped it off last time, surely.
Oh, man, you know, when there's that Fall Friday.
Yeah.
And people. I think I've said this to you, and people say that people put guest informant.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I always want to put a link to Giddy Up a Ding Dong by Alex Harvey. Yeah. All right, so that.
Wow.
It's pretty similar.
It's the same song.
But I don't think anyone's ever flagged it up, but I'm always tempted.
Oh, you heard it here first, people.
That's
well, I never do.
That's a scoop. Yeah. That is.
Have
a listen to both of them. That's it'll cheer you up.
Well, I think you mentioned it's been fun. I watched the video of them playing that is fantastic, isn't it?
It's
mad dance.
Yeah. Such a great song. Yeah.
What a front man he was, Alex Harvey. Fantastic.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. So look that one up.
There's no one around who can sue, is there?
Dead, aren't they? Anyway, you gotta make this your last question, Dan. We're running out of time.
Well, yeah, I was just interested. To what degree would you write the music with the need for lyrics and vocals on in mind, or would you just write or compose the music, put it together in the way that you were happy with, and Mark would have to fit it on?
Totally that. Occasionally, we did try every approach. He'd sometimes come up with an idea and a riff or a drum beat or whatever.
Mm.
But if we were doing something from scratch, we'd just present it to him, and if he liked it, he'd work with it.
Yeah.
And it didn't.
A lot of them were just bits of music, weren't they? They weren't like, this is where the vocal goes, or and this will be the chorus. So,
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I think some of the later bands kind of wrote deliberately, thinking this is how he's going to get his vocals in on over the top, I think. But
I mean, I think later on there was a bit of jiggity pokery, wasn't there, where his vocals moved about a bit as well.
Yeah, I think so.
No, we never did that. No,
I mean there was a few. I think it got less frequent. I mean, early on, like Joe Bonham and the Air Rifle, that was. This has to be this long, there's this much verse, there's this much chorus, and you know, there's like that was properly set like a proper song. And there's a few like that, but
yeah,
I think as it got later on, it was just two bits of music. I mean, if the stuff like where he's got two bits, you know, he's got a chorus and a verse, for want of a better word, and the song's got two bits, but they don't flow in the same way. So he'll sing sometimes he'll sing the chorus over the verse bit, and sometimes he'll sing the verse over the chorus bit. They're just like, because he liked that, didn't he? He liked the things not to be neat and tidy.
Hmm. Yeah.
And speaking of not being neat and tidy, I think we've just run out of time. This podcast is never neat and tidy, but I think that's pretty good. I mean, any idea that it was going to be a quiz was always going to be an on-starter, wasn't it?
It would just be a succession of don't knows, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was really interesting.
Thank you. it's proved that we don't know any more than each other, don't it, Paul?
Yeah, I think that's on us even there. Yeah, we both know fuck all. Yeah. All right, Bombshell. Merry Christmas, Dan. Thanks very much for joining us. I hope you have a good one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you. Cheers. Thanks for asking.
Don't the King's Speech, will you?
And we will. Hopefully, we will meet up sometime.
Yeah. Cheers. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us for this special Christmas edition of Old Brother. The next episode will be released on the 6th of January. So don't forget to follow us on Twitter, at Old Brother Show, where you can find links to our Spotify playlist. Or why not subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll be all set for the rest of Series 3. You can also give us a rating on iTunes, subscribe on YouTube, or just tell your friends if you fancy it too. For further reading, our books about the fall, The Big Midweek and Have a Bleeding Guess, are available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores, but to be honest, you've probably just unwrapped them. Merry Christmas to all who celebrate. Hope to speak to you all again soon. And remember, if you're driving, take your sleigh. Ta-da!